Okay, what? Try that again. So the subject that I want to tackle is the question of taking tzedakah from non-Jews, which, as we'll see, appears three times in three different Agadotot in the first parak. But it really has a lot of questions that relate to it. So as we'll already see, the Gemara in at least one of these places hesitates in its willingness to accept tzedakah from non-Jews. But if I asked you, okay, conceptually, what's the first question you have to ask when we're dealing with tzedakah with non-Jews? What was the first question you would ask? What? Well, before we even get that, before we get to the what's potential problem, right? If I said the topic was tzedakah from non-Jews, what was the first question you would ask? What? Very good. One question would be tzedakah. Good. And we're going to see that that's exactly one of the questions is, what do you mean by tzedakah? Both, what is the nature of the mitzvah tzedakah in general, but also more specifically, what type of tzedakah are we talking about? What other questions would you ask?
What's a non-Jew?
Yes, very good. What type of non-Jew are we talking about? Right? What else? Very good. Is this a quantitative issue? What question do you want to ask? Right? Before we even get to the question, is there a problem with accepting tzedakah from non-Jews? What question do we want to ask in the background? Well, we know for us, tzedakah is a mitzvah. Right? Is this a mitzvah for non-Jews? Meaning, what is the... Right? What's... In order to talk about this, we have to talk about, are they obligated to give tzedakah? Is there a mitzvah to give tzedakah? Do they have mitzvah? Yes, they do. Thank you. They have the Sheva Mitzvah, but you know the Sheva Mitzvah, assuming that that's the only Shita. It's not the only Shita in the Gemara, right? There are other Shita that, as we'll see, are more expansive and possibly include Staka in the Mitzvah that non-Jews are obligated in. Yeah, Ezra, what do you want to add?
Would you say that, like, just in general, being a good person, as they do that, is like an obligation?
Very good. And maybe Staka for us is a formal obligation, but maybe they're obligated in Staka for a different reason, a more general chesed or being a good person value, that's totally possible. All these are going to be part of the discussion. That's what we're going to see, is that this question really touches on a lot of fundamental questions. That's why I wanted to deal with it. And as I said, it appears sort of derech agav in the first parak of Bava Basra. Yeah. What do you mean, why do we care? I mean, very basically, first of all, it's a question of truth. If we think this is true, so then we care. Second of all, in a Jewish society, like run by Beis Din, we would be the enforcers of these laws. And even outside of there, we might be obligated to educate, or even if we're not obligated to proactively educate the way the Lubavitcher Rebbe thought we were, right? We might be obligated to tell people when they turn to us. Meaning, Ad Hayom, there are Noahide communities in the world who believe that they're obligated to Shem Etzvei Noach and unify behind that, right? There was for a while, I'm not sure if it still exists, you can look, there is a Wiki Noah.
What?
A Wiki Noah. Like a Wikipedia section devoted to Noahides, where it has resources for them, and at some point I came across this, the Wiki Noah. At least to acknowledge this, but it might look. One of the big reasons that people have been caring about this recently is for political reasons, which is in the background. This might affect the question. The answer to your question might affect how much do we have to care if American policy, for example, reflects halacha for non-Jews, not for us. No one thinks that American law has to reflect law for non-Jews. But a lot of the modern debates over what should the Jewish position on Roe v. Wade being overturned be, or abortion rights be, comes down to the question of, first of all, what does halacha think the proper approach is to abortion for the non-Jewish community? And right, if you think about the debates, right, you'll hear people who will say, well, modern culture is clearly encouraging abortion in cases that halacha would never sanction, and therefore, as Jews, we should seek out more restrictive abortion policies so more people are keeping the Torah or what the Torah thinks they should be keeping. Other people will say no, but the laws being proposed by pro-life, let's say, Catholics are much more restrictive than halacha would respect. And therefore, on pragmatic grounds, we have to encourage abortion to be legal, because if their restrictive laws pass, so then people might not be allowed abortions, even in cases where halacha would mandate it for life-saving, right? But that dialogue, and whether that's even the right dialogue they're having, depends on how do we conceptualize non-Jews' obligations, and how do we conceptualize our own obligation towards their fulfillment? I mean, these are very practical questions. This isn't just a theoretical, right? This is a very important practical question. And there are major debates about this amongst poskim, but also amongst lay leaders and laity in general, are speaking in these terms, even if they don't quite have the halachic language for it. Okay, so that's a little bit of a background. I think that, like I said, these are very broad questions that I, you know, I like tackling. And it's totally different from Hezekria. So that's, for me, that's not a benefit. I could talk about anyone's Zugia for months. But and I'm happy to, you know, make you read long tshuvot. But you want a break. And I understand that in theory. So I will go along with it. Okay, I understand it. I don't maybe identify with it, but I at least understand it. Yeah. No, that is a machloket, right? Because there's two layers of machloket. What is their obligation? And the second is, what is a Jewish obligation towards non-Jews in terms of encouraging the fulfillment of their obligations? Right? Rabbi Broid and Rabbi Bleich wrote articles on this, surveying the positions as to what we think. Okay, fine. So the first story in which this becomes relevant is at the end of this beautiful Agarata. Really wonderful. I really do love this Agarata, and I do intend on teaching it on Thursday night at some point. But it's this fascinating Agarata about Herod. So let's talk about some of it outside, and then we'll get to the critical halachic point. So let's talk about the background to the story outside. So the story starts off with the colorful background of Herod, according to the Gemara. So what is the story of Herod according to the Gemara? Okay, so even before that, the Gemara gets into this because the Gemara wants to know whether you can destroy a shul in order to rebuild it. Right? That was how this Gemara got into this whole discussion. Right? What's a shul? What? A shul. A shul. Right? If you look in Gimel Amud Beis, right, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Chisda, lo lister inish ve kenishta ad debani ve kenishta acharite. You can't destroy a shul until you rebuild the next one, right? You can't dismantle a shul until you rebuild a new one. And the Gemara offers two reasons. Ika da'amre mishum pshiyuta. Some say that the reason is because we're worried that you'll destroy the shul and won't bother rebuilding it, right? You'll claim that this is part of a rebuilding project, and it's not. You're just going to dismantle it. The ika da'amre mishum tsluye. And others people say because you'll have no place to daven while the first shul is being dismantled. And my benayu, what's the difference? Ika benayu, ika be'kinish t'achrit. The Gemara says the difference is if you have another shul, or you have a summer shul and a fall shul, or a summer shul and a winter shul, which, you know, certain communities had. I'm reading through Chaim Grada's book, The Yeshiva, and very slowly, because there are parts of it that I like. Anyways, but it talks there about the fact that they had a shul which was only used in the summer because it didn't have good insulation, right? So in the frigid Russian winters, you know, if something doesn't have good insulation, you don't use it during the winter. For those of you who live in cold really cold places, you know what I'm talking about. This would probably be true in New York. It was definitely true in you know, the years I lived in Toronto. You know, it takes getting used to. You know, the first time I went for Chag when Ara and I were engaged, it was Pesach, so it was, what, April? I left New York. I was wearing a polo shirt. It was like 65 degrees in New York. And I got to Toronto at 5, like an overnight bus, got there at 5 in the morning. It was 38 degrees and I'm in a polo shirt. And my phone was like having trouble with service. I was outside. I was dying. Like, it's unbelievable how cold it is, right? So that's basically, you know, what Jewry looked like for hundreds of years in Europe. Yeah. Okay, I can't. Right now, you don't need a mask. You're behind a wall. Yeah. Two walls. What?
Why didn't they always use the winter
shoes? Ah, because the summer... In the book, the summer shoe was nicer. Right? It was more beautiful. Okay.
Why didn't they just make the winter shoe more beautiful?
I don't know. They had X amount of money. I don't know. This is a fictional book about a community in Russia. And I don't know. In Vakelnik. I don't know where Vakelnik is. I don't even know if it's a real city. I assume it is, but I have no idea. What? Look, in camps, sometimes they have really beautiful shuls, but the shuls are, their beauty builds on the fact that they're only going to be summer shuls, right? Like, think about camp shuls, right? Some of them can really utilize the natural lighting because they know it's going to be during the summer, right? They don't, you know, they can have it be mostly windows with very little insulation, right? And just you know, no air conditioning maybe, but have ceiling fans, right? And the beauty comes from the fact that you can utilize the fact that it's the summer, but you couldn't do that in the winter, right? You know, I guess. Yeah. Anyways. Okay. So this is the background to this story in the Gemara. And the Gemara, once is talking about this, brings up this story of... Herod and the Beit HaMikdash. So in that story, he tells us, yes, his very colorful story. How does he become king? So the Gemara says he becomes king by...
Killing
what? Right, he kills out the Hasmonean kings, the entire thing, except for... And he's a servant there. He wants to leave alive only the one... young woman from the family, the Chashmonaim, that he wants to marry. She doesn't want to, so what does she do? Right, she jumps off her. It's a wonderful, like I said, there's Agadata. When we get back to Agadata, we're going to have to spend time because it's an incredible Agadata. There's so much packed into it. So she jumps off a roof and says, I am the last of the Hasmoneans, so if anyone claims they're Hasmonean, they're a liar and they're a slave. Okay? Then the Gemara says that he, maintained her body in honey, right? Preserved her body in honey, and the Gemara argues as to why he did that, right? What does the Gemara say? Why might he have kept her body in honey? Yes, either necrophilia, yes. Either because he wanted to sleep with her, or to fake that she was alive so he could have his claim to the kingdom. Okay. Yeah.
Do you think that this actually happened, or does that...
I have no idea.
Or the rabbis were a bit mad.
I have no idea. I don't know. We'll talk about the details of the Agadata more in Agadata this year, okay? In the meantime, then the Gemara says that Herod had a little bit of a hang-up with the rabbis. Why do you have a hang-up with the rabbis?
Because they don't story about it.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Because what?
Because they said he might be king.
Because halachically, we don't allow avadim to be kings. So, Herod had a very easy response, which was, kill them all, right? The rabbis don't want me to be king. Fine, then we will get rid of the rabbis. We'll get rid of the opposition, right? This is the traditional, for anyone who tells you that this is the traditional way of dealing with opposition, not the moral way, it's just the traditional way in the history of the world that people got rid of their opposition. You know... You know, for all the people who are, like, complaining that America, you know, people aren't going to cede the election, I don't know whether they are or not, but, you know, as they're saying, one of the beauties of America is that people have ceded the election, right? It wasn't a given in most of the history of the world, right? That's not how things... There weren't elections often, but, right? People didn't often cede power. That wasn't something that happened, right? The fact that America did was a chiddush. The fact that George Washington, when there wasn't yet a law that you had to only be... that you, there was, well, there wasn't yet term limits, was a miracle. Such a miracle that, you know, that an award-winning Broadway musical had to make a song about it, right? That's how incredible that moment was. I see blank looks. There's no way that you don't know that that's in Hamilton. There's no way you don't know that's in Hamilton. Come on. Come on. Let's teach them to say goodbye. Even if you have not gotten a ticket, which I have not, right? And even if you haven't yet watched it on Disney Plus, which I have not yet, because Disney Plus is not yet in Israel, you should know that this song exists. What? I think it's called Let's Teach Them to Say Goodbye. It was the song that Lin-Manuel Miranda sang for Obama in the White House. You know, we are alumni of the same institution. We are. He has an honorary doctorate from YU. Lin-Manuel Miranda, what? Before Hamilton, he had an honorary doctorate from YU. Because his previous hit play was The Heights, which was a musical about Washington Heights. And as part of YU being... I think someone in his family also has a degree from one of the YU graduate schools, like, I think Wurzweiler, like the social work school. I'm not... One of the schools, I don't... Someone in his family was affiliated with one of the YU schools, I think. But the point was that as part of YU being a institution of Washington Heights, and this was a Broadway show that sort of highlighted the culture of Washington Heights, not the YU side, the other side of Washington Heights, admittedly. They gave him an honorary doctorate, which is why, like, 2 or 3 years ago, he volunteered to be the spokesman for the YU fundraiser. It was hysterical. He was the voice of We Are YU. It was absolutely wild. It was totally wild. What? No, he didn't. He's great. He's great. You never saw the video of his wedding? It's amazing. It's on YouTube. You should see this. At his wedding, he had like a full Broadway type production of L'Chaim that he ran from Fiddler on the Roof. It's absolutely, absolutely hysterical. It is incredible. Absolutely incredible. After Sheer, you can look at, at Lin-Manuel Miranda having, it's him and his father and his father-in-law and all the best, you know, the best man and the groomsmen and the bridesmaids. They all participate in this huge, huge production of L'Chaim. It's hysterical. So yes, we are alumni of the same institution. And yes, he wrote a song in Hamilton about Washington and the chiddush of the fact that Washington taught them to say goodbye, because ceding power was, right, to quote King George from Hamilton, "I did not know that was a thing people do," right? I believe that is the line. After which he asked, what? No, I did not know that was a thing people do or did. You know, and then he asks, who's taking over? And then the song stops and he says, John Adam, right? I know him. Yeah, anyways. One day. My in-laws got to see Hamilton because, you know, it does, you know, circle around the world. So, in America, in Broadway, it's like $500 a ticket. In Toronto, they got it on their year-long membership to the theater. Because, what? It came in Wisconsin. Let's stop there for a second. Yes. Okay.
2 months before I left. Oh.
Did you go?
No.
Oh.
It wasn't the original cast.
Oh, okay. No, this was the Broadway cast, you know, not the original cast, but whatever. Anyways.
Sold out in Milwaukee and Madison. You had to go up to Green Bay, which is like...
Yeah, so it was on, in Toronto, it was on Mervish, which is like the Toronto Broadway. So fine. So the, So Herod kills everyone, becomes king. The rabbis don't want him to be king for halachic reasons, or at least, not clear they ever weighed in on it, but even in the story, they just paskin that slaves should not be kings. He doesn't like this, so he kills them. That's what? So he kills all of them, except for Bava ben Buta. But Bava ben Buta, he doesn't kill, he only blinds. Right? Only blinds. What? Yes, exactly. So that's what brings us. What? I don't know. Because he does. Fine. So then what happens? Top of Dalet Amud Aleph. Herod decides that he wants to. He wants to get a feel for what the rabbis think about him. So then you get this incredible scene, right? It's just a wonderful scene. So what happens? Yom Achad, top of Dalet Amud Aleph. Let's pick up at that point in the story. Ata v'yativ kamei. So Herod now can go and talk to Bava ben Buta in secret, because Bava ben Buta is blind, so he won't recognize him. I don't know if he changed his voice and spoke in a high-pitched voice. I have no idea what he did. Amar chazi mar hayavde bisha Mike Ovid. Oh, look at what that terrible slave who's up there as king. Look at what he's doing, right? He's trying to provoke him. He wants to see what the remaining rabbi thinks of him. Amar le, mai avid le, he said, what exactly do you want from me? Amar le, nilache mar. He said, curse him. Just curse him. Amar le, k'tiv gamimadach ha-melech al tikalel. He said, no, we don't curse kings. Amar le, hi love melechu. Yeah, but he's not a king. I got you now. Amar le, v'lahavi asher ba'alma. Okay, but he's a rich guy. Rich and powerful. We don't curse rich and powerful people either. U'k'tiv echadrin al tikalel asher. So he said, "Veloy ele nasi uktev nasi bam chalot ha'ar." He said, "Both because of power and because of wealth. Wait, we don't curse leaders. We don't curse rich people." Amar le ba'ose maase amucha v'hai lav ose maase amucha. He said, "Ha ha ha! I know that the rabbis say that you can't curse people only if they are keeping the Torah. That they're ose maase amucha. They act like good Jews. And Herod definitely doesn't fall into that category." Amar le, Mr. Fina Mine, he said, you got me. Fine. Formally, if I wanted to, I could curse him, but I'm scared of him. Are you happy now? I'm scared. Amar le, leke deinish de azil. De lemele, de anavat yativna. He said, yeah, but it's just me and you, man. Right? There's no one to hear. Amar le, k'tiv ki ofa shamayim yalichu et akol uval knafayim yagid davar. Said in Kohelet, it says that the birds shall carry your messages. The walls have ears. Right? Don't be an idiot. Right? I'm not going to say anything. Amar le, at this point, Herod is so impressed. It's funny, by the way. He's not impressed because he thinks Bava ben Buta likes him. Right? It's very clear Bava ben Buta really doesn't like him. But Amar le, anahu. It's me. I'm Herod. If I had just known that you were cautious, meaning I don't care if you like me, but if I had known that you would fear me and wouldn't curse me because you were afraid, because you were practical, pragmatic people, that would have been enough and I wouldn't have killed all of you. Okay. Love katil nalu. But now he feels bad. So he asks him, Hashta maita kante dahu gavra. What can I, or he speaks about himself in third person, what can that man, meaning me, what can I do to fix my terrible sin of, you know, is there a word for killing out all rabbis? You know, there are words, rabbi side, yeah, I don't know, right? What? Well, but I'm saying there's like words for killing, you know, a whole nation is genocide, right? Killing a god is deicide, right? What? I don't know. Clear, right? Rabbi said, cleric, I don't know, cleric. Is that a word? Killing out the clerics? I don't know. I honestly don't know. So he says, Amar le, hu kava orishal olam. He said, you put out the light of the world. Dichtiv kiner mitzvah v'torah or. Because it says that Torah is like a, right, mitzvot are like a candle, and the Torah is like light. Yelech v'asok ba'orol shel olam. So you should involve yourself in the light of the world, meaning rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Right? This is the Gemara's backstory for how Herod ended up rebuilding the temple. Right? And all the beautiful additions to the Beit HaMikdash that you can see ad hayom that Herod added. Much of what Herod built. You can still see much of what Herod built. And if you can ever leave, then right, Ginsburg's wife, who works at Ir David, will make sure you get the private tour, and you will see all the things underground that are not open to the public, and you will see the beauty of Herod's thing. That's what we did last year. We got to walk on the original road that they were Ole Regel on, which was great. It was really cool. Gavi, you were there, right? It was really cool. That was one of the few TLM I went on with Yeshiva. It was really cool. Back in another life, when people did normal things like walk, you know, back in a different world, pre-corona. But hopefully we'll get to do that this year. It's really cool. So build the Beit HaMikdash. Tichziv. Vayomine Yada, Yelech. Sorry. Dichtiv naru love kol goyim igdam riachim lehu sinev shel olam dichtiv ayam minei ayda yelech v'dad v'ene shel olam, or you blinded the eyes of the world, so be involved with the eye of the world. Dichtiv ini mechalel mikdashi gonu zchem machmarei nechem. So amar lei, so what did he say? Mistafina mimalchuta, I'm afraid of the Romans. So he gives them the following advice. Right, also great advice. Right, what does he tell them to do? Send a letter to the Romans and tell them that you're going to build the Beit HaMikdash, and start building it before the letter has a chance to get there. And this way, you have shown your allegiance, but you've gotten it done one way or the other. Okay? The Romans send back a letter, and what do they say? They said, if you haven't started, don't start. Right? Sorry, if you have already, don't deconstruct even to begin the process. If you already did that, don't start building. And if you already started building it, then what? You are a bad servant. Bad boy. We know exactly what you did. We get this trick. We understand the trick of doing it and asking for permission in a way that it takes a long time. Bad. Bad, bad slave. Bad. So that's what he does. Okay. So then if you skip down, the Gemara says, Ubava barbuta hechi avidachi, right? This is the critical part of the story for us, for the halachic purpose. Again, the Agadata we're going to have to come back to in depth in Agadata share. But Bava ben Buta, the Gemara says, how did he do this? Meaning, how did he do what? How did he give advice to Herod to build the Beit HaMikdash, to do a mitzvah? Va'amar of Yehuda Maravi, Tamer of Yehuda ben Levi, Mipnei Maneh Nash Daniel. Why was Daniel punished? V'nei Shehetzi Eitzel Nuchanetzer, because he gave Nuchanetzer advice. What was the advice? So if anyone knows Daniel, how well do you know Daniel? What just happened? You have no idea because you don't know Daniel. Daniel has a Nebuchadnezzar has a very odd dream. No, it's before that. That's later. That's another weird story. There's no story in Daniel that doesn't go in the category of weird. But this is the story before that one, where Nebuchadnezzar has a weird dream. He has a nightmare. Yes, with very complicated four different animals and towers and rocks and all types of wonderful things. Daniel interprets it and says, aha, God is angry at you because you're arrogant. And if you give tzedakah, it'll all be okay. So Nebuchadnezzar starts with this, everything starts okay, then he ends up being arrogant, then God turns him to an animal, and he lives as an animal for 7 years, and, what? Yes, he turns into an animal, and lives as an animal for 7 years. Not clear if he actually turns into an animal, machloget mafarshim, whether he turns into an animal or just lives like an animal and basically goes crazy. Okay, great story. In the meantime, Daniel said that the way you're going to save yourself from God's wrath is by giving tzedakah. That's the important part of this whole story. So the Gemara says, and he was punished. How was he punished? So the Gemara has two possibilities. Either he went from being the top of the world, because he's given like a third of the kingdom or something, to being a mere messenger boy in the time of Esther, where he's Hatach, or the punishment is that he gets thrown into lion's den, which, despite what Rami thinks, being thrown into a lion's den, even if you're miraculously saved, is scary and a punishment. Okay? It is a punishment. I don't want to be thrown in the lion's den, even if I know I'm going to get miraculously saved. And he didn't know that before he got thrown into the lion's den. Okay? Fine. What? It's a great story. All of Daniel is a great story. That's why I taught it last year. I love Daniel. It's a wonderful book. I've taught Daniel several times. I love Daniel. It's great. Besides for the fact that it's very complicated Aramaic. But it's such a good book. Everything in it is wild. People turning into animals, writing on the wall, people going into lion's den, people being thrown into fiery furnaces, and that's the first half of the book, which is less weird than the second half of the book. Okay? But the second half of the book is the predictions, where it's just crazy. Because that's all the predictions of the end of time. Great book. Totally recommend it. And I could give away, you know, I could say no spoilers, but I could tell you everything that happened in the book and it would be no spoilers because no one knows what it means. Including Daniel, who says, what does this mean? And he says, seal it in a book for something, 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 something. And no one knows what he's talking about, including Daniel. And Daniel says, what are you talking about? Ah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. For some odd weeks and something, 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 weeks and days, and you know what that means, right? And no one knows if it means years, 2,000 years. Everyone's been trying to figure this out for hundreds and for thousands of years. So far, every Rishon had a different prediction of when Mashiach was coming based on it. No one's gotten it right so far, right? The Abarbanel himself came up with like three different suggestions at different points in his life, and each time it didn't happen, right? It's a very weird book. So the Gemara says he's punished for giving the advice to Nebuchadnezzar to give tzedakah to save himself. So how could Bava ben Buta give advice to Hurdos to do a mitzvah? So what is the Gemara answer? Possibility one, Ibayt Ema Shiny Avda di Chayev mitzvot. Possibility one is servants, slaves are different because they are part Jews, so they're Chayev in mitzvot. Ibayt Ema Shiny Beit HaMikdash di Lo Machod Lo Mitbenei. Alternatively, the Beit HaMikdash is different because if you didn't get the king to do it, no one would do it, and therefore it was extenuating circumstances. Okay? That's the Gemara. Wonderful Gemara. Yes, Ezra.
Actually, I'll wait to ask.
Okay, good. So now, I stop right here. Now, tell me. From this Gemara, why is there a problem having, accepting tzedakah, or encouraging non-Jews to give tzedakah? Why? Yes?
So, it seems like the problem isn't the actual act of giving tzedakah, because we see that, like, it doesn't do a Nebuchadnezzar, like, his punishment got delayed by that, right? So he actually gets rewarded.
Ah, very good. So,
advice, but it seems like it's weird how, like, it's weird that it doesn't seem like a proper parallel for the case of Herod, because it's
good.
Something different.
Very good. There are a lot of problems going on here. Okay, good. Now, before we address Ezra's problems, let me ask you a very simple question. In this Gemara, do you think that the Gemara assumes that non-Jews are chayiv in giving in the mitzvah of tzedakah or not?
No.
I heard not. Anyone want to say yes? Someone justify why not.
What?
Justify why not.
Because there's never any compulsion by anyone to give tzedakah.
But based on this Gemara.
Yeah. There was never a compulsion to a non-Jew to give tzedakah.
Well, give me another reason. Yeah? Adam, Ezra, yeah, go. Adam. Okay, good. And okay, good. What else? Why else might you think from this Gemara that non-Jews are not chayiv in tzedakah? One is because, okay, it might not have happened with that Daniel. Another is because it seemed to be a very specific advice that he gave in one circumstance. Why else?
Also, it's like, why would you discourage giving advice?
Very good. Right? Ezra asked the more fundamental question, which is, the Gemara is telling you don't encourage non-Jews to give tzedakah. If it's encouraging you not to tell non-Jews to give tzedakah, that implies, like, it's not a good thing for them to give tzedakah, because if it's a good thing, we should encourage it. Right? And a good proof to what Ezra said is the first half of the Gemara, which is, where the Gemara said, yes, but Bava ben Buta was allowed to tell Herod to build a Beit HaMikdash because he was an Eved and was chayiv in mitzvot, which implies that Herod was obligated in mitzvot, but Nebuchadnezzar was not chayiv in the mitzvah that he was told to do by Daniel, and therefore Bava ben Buta wasn't punished for encouraging Herod to build a Beit HaMikdash, but Daniel was punished for Nebuchadnezzar because slaves are obligated in mitzvot and non-Jews are not obligated in tzedakah. The only problem is that might only be true according to answer one and not answer two, because answer two makes it sound like, no, maybe he wasn't chayiv in building the Beit HaMikdash, but they told him to do it anyways because that's the only way it was going to happen. Yeah, Yaakov. Why? Might kill us. There are other reasons why it might be bad. But yes, it might be bad policy. Now, does anyone want to argue based on this Gemara that non-Jews are obligated to give tzedakah? Or at least get a mitzvah? Yes, why? Very good. One is that, wait a second. On the one end, you might say the implication is there's no mitzvah for him to give tzedakah because Daniel is criticized for telling him, and because, right? On the other hand, he did delay his punishment, and more importantly, it seems like, as Ezra said before, Daniel isn't criticized for telling him to get tzedakah. Why is he criticized? For giving him good advice. Meaning, we don't want to let Nebuchadnezzar do a mitzvah because then he'll get schar and it'll delay his punishment, which implies that he does get a mitzvah. Right? Dafka, the reason that we don't want... Right? In this Gemara, it sounds like the reason you didn't want Nebuchadnezzar to give tzedakah was because you were worried he would do a mitzvah. Right? We don't want Nebuchadnezzar to do mitzvah because then he'll get schar. But it sounds like... Right? So there's two ways of reading this Gemara. One is, there's no mitzvah for him, but maybe it was, for some reason, it'll save him anyways, and we don't want to save him. And that's buttressed by the fact that it's contrasted with Bava ben Buta, who is chayev in building Beit HaMikdash, according to answer one, but maybe not answer two. But the other hand, it might be that this Gemara proves the opposite, which is that non-Jews are actually get a mitzvah for tzedakah. That was the problem, right? We didn't want Nebuchadnezzar to get reward because, you know, he's Nebuchadnezzar. We don't like him very much. So don't give him good advice. But fundamentally, telling an non-Jew to give tzedakah is good advice because they get a mitzvah. So you could read this Gemara and get two opposite conclusions about whether non-Jews are chayev. And then we have to deal with the question Yaakov said is, wait. One question is, are they chayev? But it's not just the question of chayev. The Gemara seems to not like the idea of accepting tzedakah from them. We got to figure out why that is. Right? Though in this case, the Gemara is more focused on the problem of them giving than us taking. Right? But we'll see whether that maintains in the other Gemaras. Yes?
What's the rationale for ever not wanting to do
it? Because he doesn't deserve the schar.
Yeah, but if he doesn't deserve the schar, then he does not get it.
No, because he did the mitzvah. So now you've put God in a bind.
But like, wouldn't God just like bound to that or whatever? Like, if he didn't do the mitzvah?
Sure, he'll still get punished, but it'll delay his punishment.
Yeah, but
there are so many theological layers to this Gemara. I agree. That's why I want to do it in Agadah. So it's so much fun. But,
I mean, does it though? I think so, right?
What?
It doesn't see its benefit probably at our expense, right? Not
oh, very good. Right? And it could be that it came at our expense. You're right. Maybe. It's the way midrashically, right, we relate to Yonah. Yonah doesn't want to let the people in Nineveh do tshuva because it'll be bad, because Ashur is going to conquer us. That doesn't mean they don't get schar for doing tshuva. It's, no, he dafka knew they were going to do tshuva, that's why he didn't want to go. Right? That's what he says. Okay.
But God makes you do that.
Correct. So it's machloka between God and Yonah. Okay. So, and Achanami.
Yeah, would we apply that? If we're trying to apply the case again, yeah, would we apply that?
Maybe we would. Maybe we wouldn't. Yes, Ezra.
So if he was a slave and then he was no longer a slave, would that not make him automatically do it?
No, he needs a shichur. He needs actually to be freed. He needs to be freed. Yeah, he needs to be freed. Okay, but this is Gemara 1, okay? This is Gemara 1, where it's very, very complicated. So let's look at Gemara 2. Look at Davchet Amud Aleph, the last three lines. Here we're going to meet Ifra Hormuz, who comes up multiple times in the Gemara. She's a very interesting character. Ifra Hormuz is the queen mother. Ifra Hormuz is Ime de Shvur Malka, the mother of Shvur Malka. Who is Shvur Malka? He is king, I believe it is king, I think he's King Shapur the Second. I think it's the second. He is the king in Persia, he's a Zoroastrian. He's a practicing Zoroastrian. Okay? Which is relevant. What?
What time period was this? Like what year around was he king?
His exact years. What Shmuel's exact forget his exact years. I mean, the time of the Gemara ranges. He's earlier. I think academically we assume that Shmuel Malka refers to King Shapur II, who is here. You see, sometimes we do biographies of rabbis, and now I'm doing of Zoroastrian, like whatever. But I only dabble in Iranian Talmudica. So like, what? There you go. Okay, I think that Shmuel Malka, we assume, is Shapur II. So there you go.
Is that during the time of
empire? It's big, but this is when the main power there religiously is Zoroastrian, which is important for us. Not in this Gemara. In other places, you see that Zoroastrians have very, very machmer Nida laws. So in Nida, you have conversations with Shvur Malka, with Ifra Hormuz, rather, asking rabbis about, like, Nida questions, right? Trying to figure out what blood is menstrual and what's not, because they also have menstrual laws. Well,
did this story happen during the time of Herod?
No. No. This is not during the time of Herod.
Before or after?
After. So if Rahorma's aim is for Malka, Shadre Arnaka de Dinare Lekamed Rav Yosef. She sends a purse full of money to Rav Yosef. And Amra Lahave Lemitzvah Rabba. And she says, Rav Yosef, I want you to take this money and do a big mitzvah with it. That was the extent of her instructions. Do a really big mitzvah with it. So the Gemara says, Yosef Rav Yosef Kama Ayinba. Rav Yosef said, a big mitzvah. What exactly is a big mitzvah? As opposed to, what is this? So the Gemara says, my mitzvah, Rabba, Amar le Abayi, Tanya Rav Shmuel bar Yehuda, in posting the Talmud, my filah pinyon shvuyim, shma mina, pinyon shvuyim, mitzvah, Rabbi. So the Gemara says, it is pinyon shvuyim. I just had pinyon haben shaila. That's why it's on my head. But well, it really wasn't a complicated shaila. It was, what day do I do the pidyon haben on? It's not really a complicated shaila, but someone asked me. Fine. Pidyon shvuyim. Because the halacha is that when you have property that's owned by minors who are orphans, so the court can appoint an apotropos, the father can appoint an apotropos before he dies, to take care of their property, and we, in general, do minimal things with their property while they are children. And the Gemara says, even though you might have thought that staka, we you know, force them to give them their estate, the answer is no, because kids are kids, they're not chayv in mitzvah, including staka. And when the Gemara gives an example of the fact that we don't make them participate in staka appeals, it says, even pidyon shvuyim, which implies that the redemption of captives is
the highest
of the high. Ah, so must be that's what we use the money for. Good, yes, Ezra. Yes. Yes, this is a great... There are a lot of fun sugyas in the first parak, and yes, Davchet is talking about the stuck obligations and why rabbis don't have to pay for security. Yeah, I know it's a fun Gemara. But you're trying to drag me onto tangents. I'm making you read three Agadotas, which are to get a tangent from all three of them, and you want me to go on a tangent of a tangent.
Maybe if the rabbis paid for the college,
maybe. Maybe. Who knows? Very good. What? Okay, good. Let's isolate this Gemara. In this Gemara, what is weird about this Gemara compared to the previous Gemara? Guys, what is weird about this Gemara compared to the previous Gemara?
They just accept the money.
Yes! No qualms, no nothing. If Hermes sends the money, not only do they accept it, what do?
They use it.
They use it. Not even that. What else do they do? They also do like lumdus in, she said she wanted mitzvah rabba. What exactly was the particular mitzvah she wanted to accomplish? Let's make sure to figure out the lumdus of what Ifra Hormuz wanted to do with her money. Right? So you have Davdalid, which says, don't let Nebuchadnezzar do a mitzvah. It's terrible. Daniel is punished. He's thrown into the lion's den for it. And then you have Davchet, where Ifra Hormuz sends staka, and you get the opposite. Rabbi Yosef is, the great Ephra Hermes, she wants to send staka. She wants it for a particular mitzvah. What does she want? What is going on? Are non-Jews chayev? Are they not chayev? Is it a good thing to accept from them and not a good thing to accept from them? What is going on in Davchet? Davchet, it's like, we are very good. So, already, if you want to distinguish between the Gemaras, so already you got to figure out, well, what possible distinctions are there and which of them are conceptually relevant? So one might be what Yehonatan raised earlier, which is, what exactly do we mean by tzedakah? Are there different types of things that maybe in modern parlance mean tzedakah but are actually different? Because here it's not regular tzedakah, this is special tzedakah called pinyon shvuyim. And maybe tzedakah is problematic and pinyon shvuyim is not. And then we have to figure out why that is, right? But of course,
then you have the problem that they accepted the money before they even figured out what it was
for. Yes, 100%. Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet. Just in this Gemara, right? Oh, okay. Maybe it's not an isser. Maybe it's advice, and maybe therefore it's more malleable. Maybe. Maybe, 100%.
What I'd like to suggest is that this is really just the Torah saying, if you're going to offer advice to non-Jews, you better pay for it.
Maybe. So, but you understand why this Gemara is at tension with the first Gemara, why we have to explain it, right? Now, I also want... I want you to already realize how many axes we have to conceptually analyze this on, right? There's the obligation of non-Jews in tzedakah. Then there's different type of tzedakah for two different reasons, right? One is their obligation to different tzedakahs different, but there was another thing which we hinted at in Daf Dalid, but let's bring it more explicitly. When the Gemara has two dayot as to whether the reason they let Herod build the Beit HaMikdash was because he was chayav in mitzvot or because you need a king to build the Beit HaMikdash, right? What exactly is the axis, the axes that Gemara is hinged on? Answer one says that the relevant question is, right, what's the second one? What's the second one? Or the first one is, what mitzvah are you obligated? What? Yeah, but what's the axis? Like, what's the motivation in that one? The first one, the first stage in the Gemara, the relevant question is, are they obligated? What's the second one? Because?
Necessity.
Yes, very good. Right? One axis that's relevant is obligation. The second is
necessity.
And in that, the Gemara, the implication might be one reason to let Herod be involved is because he's chayev. The other is he's not chayev, and maybe we shouldn't be letting him do it, but we don't have a choice because how else is the Beit HaMikdash going to get rebuilt? Right? If you think about it, right, that's a very relevant question, because if you think that we can override the potential problems of accepting tzedakah for necessity, so then it might not be accidental that the Gemara on Daf Chet isn't talking about regular tzedakah. What's it talking about?
Redeeming captive,
which by the Gemara's own admission is the greatest of all tzedakahs and the most necessary. Exactly, which might be why. So, But that highlights that maybe one of the relevant axes here is going to be, how much do we need this money? When will we bend our principles? How necessary is this money to push us to bend our principles of not wanting to take it, right? But I say that cynically and only half-jokingly, but that does seem to be part of the Cheshron and the Gemara, right? It's the axis of need, right? Maybe. Or maybe when she said mitzvah rabba, he's like, oh, take this for something really necessary. That sounds like the type of thing I could take money for, really necessary things. I just don't know what it is. Right? In a chanami. Okay, but that's Gemara 2 that's intention. Okay? Now the Gemara number 3 from Bava Basra is Daf Yud Aleph. So, someone tell me the story on Daf Yud Aleph.
Same character.
What?
Same character.
Yes, very good. We meet her again. Yes. And? So tell me the story.
She said she wanted to send money to
Rav. Let me just see. How much did I give you of this third Gemara? Okay, fine. Yeah, so we meet Ifra Hormuz again. Again, Ifra Hormuz, Ime Deshwarmalka Shadre Arba Mea Dinore Lekame Derbi Ami. Below Kablinu. This time she sends the money to Rabbi Ami, and what does he do?
Yes.
I don't want it. Oyfei. Right? As if this sugya wasn't complicated enough. And Davchet, Rabbi Yossi doesn't even say anything. Great, I'll take it. I'll figure out what you wanted. Rabbi Ami, no, I don't take money from Ifra Hormuz. No, 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 no. Yeah, okay. What happened? Shamidu kele Rava, but he sent it to Rava, and Rava took the money. The Kablinu. But why did he accept it? Bishum Shlom Malchut. So, if this wasn't complicated enough, on Daf Dalid, what's the implication? Should you take money from non-Jews? No. On Daf Chet, what's the implication?
Yes.
What's the implication on Yod Amud Bet? Yes, if that's the only way to maintain peace with the government. Right? So now, we either can read that sugya back into Daf Chet, right? That's fine. That's easy enough. What's the problem? Yeah, very good. Okay, maybe I could work out Daf Yud with Daf Chet by saying, okay, you're allowed to accept money if it's the only way to maintain peace with the government. Except, you know, you could have said the same thing about Nebuchadnezzar, but the Gemara pointedly did not, right? So, even saying you shouldn't but you can if it'll cause peace is problematic because the Gemara said that Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, you know, Daniel had a really weird relationship with Nebuchadnezzar because, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was known for throwing people into fiery furnaces who didn't do what he wanted. It's not like this is someone you don't want to have peace with, right? It's not like someone you're not scared of. You are very scared of it. Your friends were recently thrown into the fiery furnace. What? And he got punished, right? So, like, he's a pretty capricious king as things go, right? So, let's just finish the Gemara, then I'll take your question, Ezra. So this is, right? So the Gemara says, Shama Remi Ami Vikbid. And nevertheless, even though he accepted it only to make Shurmalka, or his mother, happy, Rabbi Ami got angry. Amar Le, Lit Le Biyavish Ktsira Tishavar. Don't you hold. Nashim Ba'at Me'irot Ota. Don't you think it's a problem? You're supposed to break the schut of the Rishayim. And Rashi says, Kishetichle schut shebi adan, v'yavesh lachluchet maset stakishlein az yishbru. That the Rishayim, the non-Jews will only be beaten when they run out of their schar from giving tztaka. And until then, they'll be in power. So now, in this Gemara, Rabbi Ami thinks you shouldn't take tztaka from Goyim, but why? This Gemara is pretty explicit that why shouldn't you take money from Goyim? Because they do get a mitzvah for it, right? Meaning on Daf Dalid, the simple implication was they don't, because it was contrasted to Herod. Here, the Gemara says you shouldn't take tzedakah from Goyim, specifically because they do get a mitzvah, and that's what you don't want. You want them to run out of schar, right? So, the Rava Mishum Shalom Malchut, and the Gemara said, yeah, but he did it anyways because of peace. V'riyami namishum Shalom Malchut. So he said, so Rabbi Ami should have done the same thing. So what did he answer? This is what you should have done. Take the money, but give it to non-Jews. Which would have been peaceful, But they would have, and then, according to this Gemara, do you get schar for giving money to non-Jews?
No! Oh my God.
Not clear! Because you could say, as Rami says, aha, he gave it to non-Jews so they wouldn't get schar. Or, they schar but less schar, so it's the best of the world. It's the better of the two bad possibilities here, which is not taking the money and not giving them schar, but them hating you. Or, okay, I'll take it, but I'll let them get less schar. So Rava, in fact, gave it to non-Jews. And why was Rabbi Ami angry? Because he didn't know that Rava gave it to non-Jews. This is the weird, weird Gemara we are on. So, we have one Gemara that says, it sounds like they're not chayev, and it's terrible to take money from non-Jews. You have another Gemara that doesn't even bat an eye when you take money from Pidyon Shvuyim. And a third Gemara which says, it's okay, but only if it's going to cause peace, and only if you give it to non-Jews. And the problem is because they are chayev, and you don't want them to get mitzvot. So by the time you walk out of this Gemara, if I asked you, are non-Jews chayev in staka? What's the answer?
No.
Exactly. Maybe, according to Daf Yud, they are. But, fine, are they chayev? Maybe. Do they get a mitzvah? According to Dav Yud, definitely. That's the problem. According to Dav Dalid, maybe they do, and that's why they are angry, because you gave Nebuchadnezzar, or they're not, and that's why you shouldn't give advice. Are you ever allowed to take money from non-Jews and let them give tzedakah? On Dav Chet, no problem, but maybe that's only Pidyon Shvuyim. Dav Dalid, absolutely not. Dav Yud, well, yes, but if you try to give it only to non-Jews, and it's only when it's going to cause peace. Right? And what is the relevant reason we're taking it? Is it because of mitzvah or because of necessity? And why does necessity override potential Isurim? And if it overrides potential Isurim, what type of necessity? Building the Beit HaMikdash, Pidyon Shvuyim, does it matter? Are there different layers? I don't know. Right? You understand why I said, this sugya comes up from three agaritas, but by the end, you are left with so many questions that we have to return to it and figure out what is going on. Yes, Yonatan and Ezra, go.
Two things. First of all, why would giving the money after being given to you to non-Jews?
Very good. Yeah. So Yonatan is thinking, right? Yonatan is thinking very philosophically here. He's like, wait a second. The Gemara seems to be thinking very consequentialist here, right? That only thing that matters is the result. And yes, they thought they were giving it to Jews in a sense of virtue ethics or deontological ethics, right? The act they did was giving it to Jews. But the Gemara seems to be assuming that at least by tzedaka, what matters are consequentialist ethics, and therefore you thought you gave it to Jews? That's very nice. But the schar you get is based on the consequences. In a chanami. Very good. But then you could have asked a better question, which is, why don't you burn the money? If it's all about consequences, right, just burn the money, then they don't get any schar, and they thought they got a mitzvah. Good question. Yeah? What? So maybe you can't. Very good. You were already thinking like? You're already thinking like Rashi. Very good. Very good. You are thinking like Rashi. Rashi said exactly what you said, which is, well, if you're going to take the money, why don't you not give it to tzedaka at all? The answer is, very good, because you can't lie. And Ezra is already saying that this is, where does Rashi say this? You don't know yet, because I didn't give you Rashi yet. But Rashi at the top of Daf Yud Aleph says what Ezra says, which is, you're right, you should try to avoid giving the money if you can. But even when you're avoiding giving the money, what can you never do? Lie, cheat, and steal. And on Daf Chet, why do they have to give the money straight to a big mitzvah? That's what she said. That's what she said. And you took the money, now you got
to
do it. Very good. Who's going to ask that question? The same Rashi. Rashi is going to deal with that question on the top. That's the first Rashi in the Alpha and Aleph. Very good. I'm glad Yonatan and Ezra are both thinking like Rashi. That's a good person to think like. Yes.
Are these different cases, or are they just very different repetitions?
No, they're different cases. Okay. Different people.
Okay.
Right? So, what we have to do now that we have at least read these Gemaras, now we've got to systematically go through it. And let me just remind ourselves what we need to do here. Okay? One, we need to figure out a non-Jew is obligated in staka. not obligated at all, or something in between. Like, it's valuable, but it's not a mitzvah, right? Then we got to figure out, two, is the reason that we wouldn't want to accept tzedakah from non-Jews because they get a mitzvah, and we don't want them to get mitzvot, or because it's not a mitzvah, in which case, why do they get schar? Question three, why in certain cases do we clearly take money from them? Clearly the issue is partially necessity-based, but we got to figure out what does that mean. And I will point out, I was listening to a shiur a while ago by Rav Shurlo, and he points out that these aren't just local halachic questions. These are actually very broad philosophical questions. So let me give you an example of the type of question that seems to emerge from our Gemara. Okay? Tell me if this sounds familiar at all. Should you accept donations from people who got their money in shady ways or less than ideal ways? So then you'll have some people who will say, no, you're compromising the integrity of your charity if you take money from whoever, Bernie Madoff, whatever you want. And what will other people say? That's the really cynical way, but other people might say, but on the other hand, if he's donating money to poor people, they need to eat. It's very nice that you want to be all pure in your, right, in your donations, but is your purity of conscience worth people starving, right? Meaning there's a real tension in policy and philosophy between, on the one hand, not wanting to let people assuage their guilty conscience of how they make money by letting them give charity, with the reality that your purity of conscience may lead to some people not actually having money. I remember someone once asked Rav Lichtenstein when I was in yeshiva, you know, Slicha Harav, why? Anyone ever been to Gush?
Yeah.
So, you ever been through Shar Mexico? So one of the main gates to the yeshiva is called Shar Mexico. Why is it Shar Mexico? Because it was donated by Marcus Katz. And someone said, Rav Lichtenstein, with all due respect, why does the yeshiva take millions of dollars from Marcus Katz? Why don't they like Marcus Katz? Because he was an arms dealer. And he sold money to questionable entities like China. And so questionable, he wasn't allowed by law to live in the United States and has a private militia. I mean, he died now, but had a private militia that protected his house in Mexico. Hence, Shar Mexico. But not only is Gush Shar Mexico, right, donated by Marcus Katz, who also got Kohen every year on Yom Kippur in Gush. Anyone who ever used Wayut Torah? Yes. Do you know the official name of the website if you look on it? The Marcus and Adina Katz Wayu Torah. So, he, right? And Rav Lichtenstein's response was, look, I'd rather that he made his money as a bookseller. But there's nothing technically usher about selling arms, right? But this is a real tension, right? Now, it's not just Marcus Katz, right? I'm not weighing in on his personality, but I'm saying there are people who have a problem with taking money from Marcus Katz because he was an arms dealer, and they don't like arms dealers, right? But very, very prominent institutions, both of which I've learned with and are led by very serious Talmidei Chachamim, have taken money from it. It's sort of funny where all the things are funded in these places, right? Meaning, Wayu Torah is funded by arms deals, right? The most advanced kollel in YU, the Wexner Kollel Elyon, is funded by Wexner owns Victoria's Secret. Right, that's where his money comes from. The most advanced kollel in YU is funded by, right? Look, Tzedakah is a weird, philanthropy is weird. What do you want from me? But these are the questions we're going to deal with. Right, Przanski is here, so I'm going to stop. So.